We know the jobless situation is bad. What we're still trying to figure out is exactly how bad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, August 6th, and we're glad to have you with us. We begin today with unemployment, and I'm going to hit you with a bunch of numbers. Tomorrow morning, the Labor Department will release its employment report for July. The June report showed that nearly 18 million Americans were out of work. This morning, we learned that just shy of 1.2 million people filed for first-time unemployment last week. They join the roughly 30 million Americans who are already claiming unemployment benefits. So 18 million, 30 million, 31 and 2? How many unemployed Americans are there right now? Other than, you know, a lot. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to crunch the numbers.
Let's start with those unemployment claims. Economists like this number because it's up to date and reflects the actual number of claims states processed last week, says Joe Bruswellis at RSM Consulting.
All of the people who were receiving some form of unemployment benefits, and that's north of 31 million people.
On the other hand, the Labor Department's monthly jobs report for June pegged the number of unemployed Americans at just under 18 million. But that's likely lowball right now, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute. To be counted as unemployed, you have to be actively looking for work. But in COVID times,
there are many people that are not actively looking because they are taking the advice of the health experts in this country. Maybe they're caring for children right now whose schools have been closed.
Former BLS Commissioner Erica Groshen has her own formula for counting total unemployment right now.
What I've been doing is adding up all of the people whose jobs have been disrupted. The bulk of them are probably pandemic or recession related.
Including those waiting to be called back from furlough and part-timers who want full-time work, she comes up with 25 million. Back in February, before the pandemic hit, 158 million Americans had jobs. So about one in six of them don't now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We got new numbers on consumer debt today from the New York Fed. And while those unemployment numbers would seem to suggest a big uptick in credit card debt, that's actually not the case. Household debt fell in the second quarter of this year, the first decline since 2014. But that seems to be because of federal relief programs. And some of those, like the $600 a week supplemental unemployment benefit, have expired. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The New York Fed says credit card debt was down by $76 billion in the second quarter, the steepest decline in card balances since the New York Fed started tracking them. One reason, people aren't going out as much. But George Washington University economist Jay Shambaugh says there's something else going on.
Many people don't put their money in a savings account. They don't really have an active savings account. What they have is a credit card balance that fluctuates. And if they get a jolt of income, they're going to pay down the balance.
That jolt of income? It was the $1,200 relief checks and the $600 per week unemployment supplement, which just expired. And Elizabeth Kunkel, an economist at the job site Indeed, says the $600 weekly payments were roughly 5% of all disposable personal income in June. To make ends meet without them?
At first, it would be digging into one's savings. And after that, probably turning towards the credit cards.
But credit cards may not be an option. Joelle Scally, a senior data strategist at the New York Fed, says banks have cut their credit card customers' credit limits. And Scally says low-income consumers may have as little as $150 of available credit to begin with.
For lower-income borrowers, they really may not have much credit at all to draw on, and this reduction in credit limits may actually affect them.
So people in precarious financial situations are caught between the end of some benefits and having no or very little credit to turn to. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Apple hit an all-time high. An index of global stocks erased all its losses over the past year. Ignore everything we just said, friends. Apparently it's smooth sailing. Details and some real numbers when we do the numbers. With the news yesterday that Chicago's public schools will resume remotely next month, leaving only a handful of the nation's biggest school districts planning any in-person education, people are starting to get serious about solutions, including technology to either enable remote learning or improve it. One innovation that we don't usually think about in schools is robots. Ayanna Howard is a roboticist and professor at Georgia Tech. She's also the chief technology officer of Zai Robotics, which creates mobile therapy and educational products for children with disabilities. Professor Howard, thanks for coming on.
Nice to meet you.
So, I want to start by saying that absolutely on brand for our interview, about a month and a half into shelter in place, I bought myself a Roomba. And it seems like I am not the only one. tell us how this pandemic has changed or could change people's approach to robotics in their home.
So it has changed, and I think it will continue to change. So one of the things, if you think about human and people's relationship to robotics, it's been kind of a love-hate relationship. Like most people, they might buy a Roomba, for example, but a lot of like, no, I'm not doing that. Like robots, please no. But what we've seen now is there's this adoption of robots in the home, in the workplace, in the hospitals and clinics, because it fulfills a need that cannot be filled by people anymore.
And then what do you think that we'll start to see around robotics and education? I wonder what you see the role of tech and robotics playing in distance learning for those kids and maybe kids across the country.
It's kind of this thing is like, you're excited, but you're not excited about the reason for it, right? But the excitement is that how do you integrate these tools in the home environment, which is, I won't say is an easier space, but it's much more of a adaptable, dynamic space, which we've been trying to do for years of how do you do, you know, personalized learning in the home, but the need hasn't been great because the individuals who say could afford it would hire a human tutor. And now we have this need because we know that a kid that's a fifth grader logging in through Zoom to the classroom, it's not as effective as maybe for college age kids. But the robots can provide that. They can interact with the child. Because we have so many good systems that can understand eye gaze and attention, they can adapt. They can figure out based on how a child is interacting with the system, whether the kid is getting it or not. And so it really is personalized learning and tutoring. And so they do fill a need that we're sorely missing. And now the entire world sees that this is a need.
Is there a possibility, though, that they only fill the same need? They fill that need only for those families who could have otherwise afforded a tutor?
Typically, in the old days, before COVID time, I would say yes. But now there's so much of an emphasis and an effort to make sure that the world is accessible. A lot of people are impacted, which means that there's a lot of companies, there's a lot of startups, for example, that are trying to figure out, well, how do we lower the cost of that? And as you know, with supply and demand, the more individuals, the more kids that are using it, the lower the cost. So then it becomes how many kids do you know, at least in the U.S., have access to some type of phone device or a smartphone? It's pretty much that's pervasive now. Can we make that for robotics and AI?
So you think that cycle of innovation where, you know, for early adopters, things are really expensive and then it gets cheaper. It sounds like you're saying that cycle could happen sort of like exponentially faster just because of necessity.
Yes, because of necessity. And that's what the pandemic is pushing. It'll be parents, it'll be school systems, it'll be governments that say, oh, yeah, we need to push this and we need to invest in it so that we can get it to that point where every child has access to the education that they need. Otherwise, the entire world will fall behind in terms of education.
Yep. Ayanna Howard is a roboticist and professor at Georgia Tech. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
A version of this interview was in the hour-long Marketplace Tech special, The Pivot Point, part of our three-part series called The Economy, What Now? You can hear that on public radio stations or online at marketplace.org. Calls for racial justice are happening in almost every sector of the economy, including the music industry. Record labels have long been accused of racist, exploitative practices toward their artists. This summer, the Black Music Action Coalition, a group of writers, producers, musicians, and others, are calling for more than corporate donations. They want labels to, in their words, make things right for Black artists and executives. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports on what that looks like.
One night back in the 1950s in Knoxville, Tennessee, a young Chuck Berry was driving to a club to play his hit song, Maybelline.
Maybelline, why can't you be true?
But when he got there, the owners were surprised to find out Berry was Black. And they didn't let Black people play at the club. So Chuck Berry, the father of rock and roll, had to sit in his car and listen to some white musicians play his biggest hit. And even though Berry wrote Maybelline himself, he had to share writing credits, and therefore earnings, with two white men, a DJ who'd promoted the song and a guy who Berry had never even met, who'd loaned money to the label. It wasn't until the 80s that Berry finally got sole credit. Activists say these attitudes are still around.
The business hasn't changed, you know, in terms of how the business is set up. And it's been this way since the beginning.
Ron Sweeney is a veteran music lawyer. He's represented P. Diddy, Lil Wayne, DMX. He says he remembers back in the 90s when he started representing James Brown. He looked at Brown's contract and saw...
James Brown, the biggest artist ever, was only getting a 3% royalty.
Yes, James Brown. This James Brown.
Get up, get on up, stay on the scene. Get on up.
Nowadays, Sweeney says a major artist would make no less than 18%. In the end, Sweeney says he shamed the label into giving James Brown around 12%. The industry has been accused of exploiting musicians of all backgrounds, but law professor Fumi Arewa with Temple University says labels especially profited off Black musicians who were already in vulnerable positions.
The whole idea about copyright is that we're supposed to reward creativity. And what we see systematically is business structures and uses of copyright in ways to deprive African Americans of benefits that should have flowed to them.
Fast forward to 2020, and many say the industry hasn't changed enough, including the lack of diversity in record label boardrooms.
A lot of the things that happen in the industry is like a good old boys club type thing. And the hard part is breaking into that little circle, that little bubble, right?
That's Joe Connor, a drummer and talent scout for Deep Well Records. He started off as a driver for one of the label executives, and when he finally got into the executive meetings himself...
I would notice that, you know, I was the only brown person in the room, or I was the only Black person around, you know what I mean?
Major labels like Sony and Warner have pledged $100 million each to social justice groups. They've also committed to diversifying their leadership ranks. Josh Kuhn at USC studies the music industry.
I think it's great that labels are saying that they're going to do this and that. But I think if you look at over a century's worth of unequal royalties in the music industry, we're looking at dollar figures that are astronomical.
Universal and BMG have said they are looking into paying back artists whose contracts were heavily weighed against them. BMG said it will update artists, quote, in the coming days. Universal didn't respond to a request for comment, and the Black Music Action Coalition declined to comment. Music lawyer Ron Sweeney again.
These companies have made a tremendous amount of money, and if they make a lot of money off of Black music, you know, it's crazy, almost like a country club. And so folks are saying, open up the country club and let us join.
The days of segregated venues like the one Chuck Berry got turned away from are gone. But the color of power in music is still white. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So it's like, if we can't get it, let's create it.
Economic inclusion and app development. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 185.6% to close at 27,386. The NASDAQ was up 109.1% to end at 11,108. And the S&P 500 rose 21.6% to end at 3,349. Mixed news today if you're looking to buy a home. Average 30-year mortgage rates fell to a record low of 2.88%, according to Freddie Mac. On the downside, housing supply remains limited. Freddie Mac estimated earlier this year the U.S. would need to build 2.5 million more homes to address the shortfall. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Gas flaring is what happens when oil producers burn natural gas that's a byproduct of getting that oil out of the ground. It is a big contributor to the greenhouse gases that cause climate change. It also wastes gas and is dangerous to people who live near places where it happens. The U.S., Russia, and Venezuela tend to do it the most. In the U.S., a lot of flaring happens in Texas. And this week, the Texas Railroad Commission, the group that regulates oil and gas in that state, said it's implementing changes to hopefully reduce the amount of gas getting burned off. But Marketplace's Andy Euler reports it's going to be a tough ask until the economics make sense.
You know those tall stacks of pipes on top of refineries that shoot flames up into the air? Well, that's an example of flaring.
We're flaring about 1% of U.S. production.
That's Robert Kleinberg at Columbia University. He says, that doesn't sound like a lot.
But U.S. production is very large, and 1% is the equivalent of supplying something like 7 million homes.
Flaring natural gas is a waste, but the problem is getting that gas to those homes is expensive. Kleinberg says companies flare because natural gas is cheap, and figuring out a way to use it is often more costly than just burning it.
If you're way out in West Texas with no convenient pipe, or if pipeline transportation costs are higher than what you could get at the marketing hub, then you'd flare it because there's no economic driver for saving it.
By one measure, oil companies operating in the Permian Basin of West Texas wasted $750 million worth of natural gas in 2018. Varun Rai is director of the Energy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. He says increasingly, third parties are tracking flaring activities with drones and satellites.
And that's just, you know, bringing a whole different level of scrutiny of the operation.
Regulators in Texas this week told oil companies they need to offer more thorough justifications for why they need to flare. In part, that's to curb damage to the environment. Flaring emits carbon dioxide, methane, and other pollutants into the atmosphere, contributing to climate change and poor air quality near refineries. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Economics 101 here. If you want to understand the laws of supply and demand and how they affect prices, there may be no better place to look than the dairy business. Milk is perishable. It's got to be consumed or processed into cheese pretty much right away. It is extremely sensitive to changes in supply and demand. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, dairy farmers have seen a lot of changes in the last few years.
Last year, when I talked to Wisconsin dairy farmer Sarah Lloyd, she told me milk was just too cheap.
We really do have too much milk on the market.
Russia wasn't importing any. The EU was producing more of its own. Then the trade war with China hit, and Lloyd had to borrow money to keep her 400-cow farm afloat.
The Nelson family farm has been in business for over 100 years. We're really just digging deep into the asset base that the generations have built.
Some of her fellow farmers got out of the business. Supply came down and prices started going back up. And then COVID-19 hit. All that milk suddenly had nowhere to go. Prices tanked again. Today, Lloyd says those kinds of gyrations are not sustainable in the long run.
Because no business can operate that way, just not knowing how you're going to cover your costs from an even day-to-day basis.
When it comes to dairy, there is a very fine line in that supply and demand.
Dairy farmer Joe Bragger is president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation.
It only takes a few percent shift to make a big impact on prices.
With the food service industry shut down, farmers cut back production and dumped milk they couldn't sell. Then the government started buying excess dairy to deliver to people in need, and prices edged up. Ag economist Dan Sumner at UC Davis says dairy farmers started ramping up production.
They have added some heifer calves that might not have made the cut a year ago. They've kept an old cow on a few more months that might not have been profitable a year or two ago.
Sumner says that means prices could fall again, and that worries Wisconsin dairy farmer Sarah Lloyd.
You know, I still have my banker knocking at the door saying, hey, remember that X amount of dollars you borrowed last year to try to hang on? Well, when are you going to pay that back?
Lloyd says that's going to be a lot easier if milk prices are more stable. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Buying black, that is, consciously buying from black-owned businesses, is a movement that's been around for a while, but lately has regained momentum. So maybe you yourself have been on Google or Yelp lately and searched for a black-owned business near you or tried to find one online to support. And maybe you've thought, you know, I wish there was an app for this. Well, there are apps for that.
My name is Ramesh Badu. I am the creator of the Black Nation app. I really believe that we're part of the solution for what we say that we want, which is to be able to have, you know, that economic inclusion, that equity. So it's like, if we can't get it, let's create it. So that's why even building the application and getting to where we are today, it's been self-funded. We haven't had the ability to, we've tried getting investors and you know, making this idea, you know, we've tried. It's just, it's very limited on what we can do. But throughout that process, it hasn't stopped or slowed us down at all. So as far as the Black Nation project, it's literally, three of us. So that's it. So we're running and doing everything that we can. The Black Nation app, I initially had the idea back in 2018, because I felt the gap in finding, you know, black owned businesses that we can support and not having necessarily the resource. You know, if you Google it, you know, you may not find much of anything. And we identified a lot of businesses don't have websites. So being able to find them as well and support them was important for me. In recent events, we've seen, you know, a big shift in our country, and I saw the greater demand for just a community of people. So that sparked the idea, you know, let's turn Black Nation into a social platform. By doing so, we allow people to create their own profiles to not only find black-owned businesses, but you can now follow them and engage with them, you know, purchase products. When I was looking at the monthly report for June, we saw that we were well over 100,000 downloads and thousands, you know, well over 1,000 plus reviews. And it's great to get feedback such as, you know, we've been selling out our inventory, you know, seeing businesses become successful that have never, you know, had those peaks or seen sales at this type of volumes. It really makes me feel good that I've been a part of that.
That was Ramesh Badu in Florida, founder of Wincore Technologies and the Black Nation app. If you've got a little time, and a fair number of us do these days, tell us about your economy online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out sounds like good news on its face. The State Department today lifted its more than 4-month-old advisory telling people not to travel anywhere outside the United States because of the coronavirus. Now the State Department says things have improved globally enough that it's returning to country-specific warnings. Unfortunately for us, we might be ready to travel, but many countries around the world, including Europe and the UK, are currently closed to American tourists. One last moment of economic context. Uber reported earnings today. Its revenue was down 29% because no one is taking any cars anywhere. But the earnings actually beat expectations, mainly because food delivery bookings were up 113%. That was pretty much all me, you guys. I cannot handle any more cooking. I can't. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.